This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today we're bringing you the story of a little six-year-old girl who went to sleep one night but was discovered missing from her home the next morning. And almost 50 years later, police are still trying to solve the mystery on Maple Avenue.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
On the evening of Saturday, May 7th, 1985, the Shanes household settles down for the night in their two-story Victorian-style home on Maple Avenue in Jackson, Michigan. It's a residential street located in a quiet, historic neighborhood. According to Susan Shanes, in an appearance on the Steve Wilkos show, the kids were sick and they wanted to sleep downstairs. She said this was the very first time she'd ever let them sleep down there. Susan's daughter, Mandy Shanes, is 46 today. She was 8 years old in 1985, and she told us that she remembered playing outside that day and that she wasn't feeling well when she went to bed. According to Mandy, all of the kids slept on the couch in the living room that night. Her half-brothers, Adam, age 10, and Chance, 6 months old, and sisters Desiree, age 4, and Natasha, who was 6. Mandy told us that they all had different fathers, but their mother was Susan Shanes. At the time, Susan was seeing a man named Robert Forbes. He was the father of 6-month-old Chance, and he was also in the house that night. Again, in her appearance on the Steve Wilkos show, Susan said she woke up the next morning at around 6 a.m. and went downstairs to get the kids up for school. When she entered the living room, she noticed that Natasha was not on the couch with her siblings. She saw that the side door was standing wide open, and the house felt chilled, as if the door had been open for some time. She said that Natasha's little shoes and purse were still lined up, ready for her to go to school. Susan checked the whole house, but there was no sign of her missing daughter. She called police. According to authorities, Natasha was reported missing at 6:48 a.m., and the first officer arrived on scene by 7 a.m. The home was searched, and the daycare that Natasha had been attending was also contacted. Police were told that Natasha would not willfully go with anyone she didn't know. Susan's boyfriend, Robert Forbes, had apparently left the residence before police arrived to look for Natasha. But he was interviewed a short time later and shared a story similar to Susan's, saying he'd return home around 2:30 a.m. and the house was locked. He saw the girls sleeping downstairs and then went up to bed. Now, here's where we have a slight discrepancy. Mandy remembers all of the kids sleeping downstairs when she went to bed. Robert Forbes said that he saw the girl sleeping downstairs when he came home at 2:30 a.m. He made no mention of 10-year-old Adam or his own 6-month-old baby boy, Chance. That information will come into play later. I spoke with Detective Mike Galbraith, who has the Natasha Shanes case today. He told me that there wasn't a lot of evidence in this case.
The door was open, but then nobody could give an explanation or didn't recall it ever being open or having heard it be opened, whether slammed or unlocked. There was no breaking. There was nothing damaged to get into the house. If she walked out or they came in and got her, the door was open, and they just left without damaging any property.
According to Detective Galbraith, Susan made a statement during the initial police response that at some time during the night, she heard what sounded like someone being struck by a car. She didn't get up to check it out, and no one else in the area heard anything similar. Oldest daughter Mandy told me that she'd slept through the night without incident, but when she woke up that morning, she remembers the house was flooded with people looking for her sister. She remembered the police combing through every room in the house and going up and down the street with a PA speaker calling Natasha's name. The original investigators conducted a thorough search of the house and the yard, and as Detective Galbraith told us, they found no damage to the side door that Susan said was standing wide open, and no sign of forced entry anywhere into the house. In fact, detectives were unable to find any forensic evidence at all. Natasha was just gone.
There was no forensic evidence at the time. That's been one of the big things that when the case would be revisited over the years because of all developments and things in that arena, you know, from evidentiary identifications and different things that could be done with DNAs, there was just nothing there. There was no forensic materials that could be resent to the lab or resubmitted to the lab for additional evaluation because there wasn't anything.
Melvin Hartman was a detective with the Jackson, Michigan Police Department back in 1985. He told me about the first hours of the investigation into Natasha's disappearance. Now, the phone connection wasn't great. We've cleaned it up as much as we could, but you're going to want to hear what Mel Hartman has to say.
Yes, I was a detective. I had just came recently back into the detective bureau. I had been out on a undercover narcotics assignment for a little over a year. When she became missing, I contacted some of my people to find out what was going on because I didn't know anything about Natasha, but her mother was dating one of the number one drug men in Jackson.
And that number one drug man in Jackson was Robert Forbes.
Well, everybody was called in to the conference room for the general information and to assign and to search team to go out and canvass the neighborhood to see if, you know, what we could find out, being the fact that Mom was dating Robert Forbes, to see if there was any connection there.
So as detectives start digging a little deeper into Forbes' background, the Jackson PD commander coordinates the ground search. He forms 8 different search teams, breaking the city into sectors. Each team was assigned a sector to search and canvas. Arrangements are also made through Channel 2 TV News to use their helicopter for an air search of the entire city. And Natasha's family does what they can to help by making and distributing flyers. You can see one of those original flyers in our show notes. At the time of her disappearance, Natasha's described as 4 foot tall and about 57 pounds. She has brownish blonde hair and brown eyes. She has a scar on her right cheek from a dog bite, a small scar on her forehead from a fall onto some gravel, and a strawberry birthmark on the back of her neck. She has pierced ears and was last seen wearing a white shirt and a blue jean skirt with a safety pin on it. Natasha has epilepsy and requires medication on a regular basis. As the search continues, investigators question everyone close to the missing girl. They interview Natasha's mom, Susan, and the fathers of all the children in the household. But they especially want to talk to Robert Forbes. I asked Mandy Shaines about Forbes, the man her mother was dating. She told us that he was very quiet and polite, but he didn't really play with the kids or have much personal interaction with them because his focus was mainly on spending time with Susan and his own infant son, Chance. Jackson police continue to scour the Shaines neighborhood looking for answers. But Detective Hartman said that the initial canvas of the area on day one did not garner any leads to Natasha's whereabouts. And then he told me what happened on day two of the investigation. The day when Robert Forbes came to his house.
I got off work at 5 o'clock and went home and sitting on my front porch going to listen to the Tigers baseball game. And I look down the street and I see him walking, which was unusual. He just did not walk the street. And so he kept coming toward the house, and finally he knocked on the door and asked if he could come in and talk to me. And that's when he came in and told me, he says, "I've done a lot of things in my time." He says, "I've never hurt a child, and I did not hurt Natasha." And I said, "Well, you need to tell me more about what's going on." He says, I'd rather not at this time," and then he just got up and left.
Detective Hartman told me that he'd lived in the same house for more than 25 years. His address was common knowledge to people from the neighborhood, so he didn't find it odd that Forbes knew where he lived. I asked Detective Hartman if he felt that Forbes was trying to set up an alibi or some defense about his possible involvement with Natasha's disappearance.
No, I never thought that he did, but the look upon his face, which told me that this man didn't have anything to do with her disappearance, not anything direct with her disappearance.
According to police, Forbes stated that he had, quote, "no idea who would be vindictive enough to bother the children that had revenge with him in mind," end quote. So Hartman felt that Forbes might not have any direct connection to her disappearance, but he still wanted to question him further. The next day, which was day 3 of the investigation, the possibility of officially questioning Robert Forbes became impossible. Detective Hartman left his home that morning, heading to the police department.
And I go to work the next morning, and I had to come right down the main street, Francis Street, and I saw the officers were by an alley. And so what I did was I went on into headquarters, and they told me that they had found Robert Forbes in the alley. Most of his head was missing.
Did Robert Forbes kill himself, or was he murdered? What did the coroner think?
First, they wanted to label as a suicide, but I talked to the prosecutors, and they agreed to leave it as open without a charge on it yet. And so that's when I started to investigate a little bit more on it.
And after some digging, Detective Hartman is convinced that it was a homicide. Nat Gross is also a former Jackson police officer, and after 22 years on the department, he went to work with the prosecutor's office, working on cold cases. He adamantly agrees with Detective Hartman.
I'll tell you what, Robert Forbes wouldn't take his own life. There was no reason for him to kill himself. He didn't carry that kind of a guilt. He didn't commit suicide.
It was apparent that Forbes' dealings with the underworld ran deep. Detective Hartman shared some information he got from an informant.
Robert Forbes, like I said, was the main drug dealer in town there for heroin and cocaine. Well, what had happened was that there was a group of guys, I think there was five of them at the time, and they were model citizens of Jackson. Owned a business, each one of them owned separate businesses, but they gathered together, fund their money, and give it to Forbes, who would go to New York, pick up all the drugs, bring them back, he would sell the drugs, and then he would give them a portion of it. Well, then they felt they should have got more, but they were all afraid of it, deadly afraid. So after a bit of time, they were trying to get rid of Forbes, but they didn't exactly know how. And then all of a sudden, there's a new guy here in town, and everybody's afraid of him. And so they approached this guy, and they asked him about if he'd be willing to take out Forbes. And he says, give me $5,000 and consider it done. Well, they made two attempts to get him, but it didn't work. He was not injured. Okay, and so they needed a plan. And I'm getting this from another informant who's gone now, but the plan was that they needed some leverage to get him out because he would always go to that house on Stanley Street. That was his mother's house, but she was in a nursing home. But he never did anything illegal from that house. That's how much respect he had for his mother.
The purported attempts on Robert Forbes' life were unsuccessful. So they allegedly come up with a new plan for Forbes. According to retired detective Mel Hartman, here's what people on the street were saying.
They needed a way to get him out of the house. Okay, this is where Susan Shane comes in. She had just had the birth of Robert's child. And so there was an agreement struck between the hitmen and the mother, that she would leave the window, downstairs window partially open with the child laying on the sofa, and so that they could take the child to use as leverage to make him come to a location so they could kill him. Well, what had happened was sometime during the night, the baby started crying, and the older brother came downstairs. He took the baby upstairs with him. Natasha, who had fallen down, climbs up on the sofa and falls asleep. And so he took Natasha. And so having seen that they had Natasha, and that's when they stuck a shotgun in his mouth and made him pull the trigger.
So this group of men were supposedly trying to muscle their way into Robert Forbes' illicit operations, something that Forbes was not willing to go along with. As Detective Hartman mentioned, there was a lot of talk on the street. Here's retired Detective Nat Gross.
I was also told that what happened was they wanted a part of his business. Some other people from another town wanted part of his business, and he told them no. And they got a hold of Natasha's mom, and they called her Crinkle on the street because of her hair. She was a kind of a redhead with real curly hair, and they called her Crinkle. And basically, they went to her and told her that if we don't get part of this business, there's going to be hell to pay. Well, they kind of confused who was who, and they took the wrong child.
Detectives continue their investigation, following up on any leads and possible theories, one of which was that Natasha had just wandered off, another that a bus driver picked her up because she was standing outside alone, but no evidence was ever found to corroborate those theories. Time passes with no new leads, and Natasha's case goes cold. Detective Hartman hasn't given up, though. He's also still looking into the alleged murder of Robert Forbes. I asked him about the two prior attempts on Forbes' life.
I think one was a drive-by shooting on one of the local streets where he was sitting in his car, and the other one was they chased him down one of the byways there in the city and were shooting at him, but they could never get up to him enough to get close to the killing.
I asked him if the prosecutor took that information to a grand jury.
No, they wanted more. And so that took several years. Something like maybe 4 or 5 years later, just kept working on it and working on it and working on it. And so finally I made contact with the number one guy who was suspect in killing him. But what he did was he subcontracted the killing to somebody else.
At this point, Hartman told me that all he had to identify the person who he suspected of killing Robert Forbes was a nickname.
And it took me over 3 years to finally get a last name, track this guy down who was just happened to be in Jackson at the prison there.
Hartman shared what his source said happened to Natasha.
And I said, but I need to know where this child is at. He said, well, the child's dead. That she got sick and she died that same night. And so they just put her in the trunk of the car. And when they went back to Detroit, they bagged her up and put her in a suitcase. And so I said, well, what did you do with her? So they took her over to a gambling house where they would always meet at. And everybody else, well, they would go outside, you know, people that they had killed, and they just buried them in that backyard.
Hartman said that about 2 months after last speaking with that source, he goes back to interview him again.
So I go back out to, in about 2 months, to talk to this guy, and he had died 2 days earlier, cancer.
Detective Hartman was deflated. But he and Detective Nat Gross get hold of another informant who claims to have information. They go with him to Detroit to try to narrow down the location where Natasha might be buried, which could finally move the case forward. Here's Nat Gross.
I would say to find Natasha, yes. That would probably help us find Natasha. But the problem is the guy that we actually think was responsible for it is deceased. We had an informant that took us to a place and said that Natasha is right here. This is where she's buried. And he explained it, how the house used to be there. It was an after-hours blind pig. And that there was a garden that was there and that he actually saw the child in a suitcase in the trunk of the car. And she was already deceased. And that she was buried in a garden there, like a regular tomato garden.
You heard Detective Gross talk about a blind pig. I asked him what that was.
An after-hours blind pig is a place where people used to go to drink and gamble after the bars closed because, you know, after 2 o'clock in the morning, the bars don't serve anymore. They close up and away you go.
So the house that used to be there was gone. I asked Detective Gross how the informant knew that was the location.
The only thing I can tell you is that I remember the way it was described to me, how he knew that was the spot, was that back in the day, there was a shootout, and there was a couple guys standing behind a tree, and there was a Burger King on the other side. The Burger King's now been torn down, and that they hit the tree, and the informant was talking about him and these other two guys. And that they hit the tree and missed the guys who were sitting behind the tree because they hit the tree. The Burger King was across the street. It was to the south. And the After Hours Blind Pig was to the north and to the, I believe it was to the east, is where the Comcast little building sat with a just a small fence around it, but the rest of it was all wide open because we were walking all through there. It's a big, huge lot. It's got where there used to be, sometime after all this happened, they had a factory that was put in there that they tore down, and all that's left of it is just part of the concrete ground.
This area has undergone some changes since the time when Detectives Gross and Hartman were there, but you can check out a diagram of this area in our show notes.
What they had next to it was a big, huge cement floor, but where that house was is still grass, and all we'd have to do is get the ground-penetrating sonar to go through there, and all you'd have to do is go back and forth, but they tried to tell us that it was owned by one of the cell phone companies. At a small, or like Comcast, or a cable company. I can't remember exactly right now what they had.
But according to Detective Hartman and Detective Gross, the officials in Detroit didn't seem interested. Rumor had it that the location could have been some kind of dumping ground.
And in the backyard, that's where they used to bury people at. And so we tried to get enough equipment, ground-penetrating radar, could not get that. Could not get any assistance out of Wayne County. But it was years later that I found out that we couldn't get any other additional help because they didn't want to go to the expense of trying to identify 16 other bodies that were buried there.
Hartman worked narcotics for a long time, frequently working with informants. I asked him how confident he was in the information he was getting.
I had full confidence in him. That I believe that he was being truthful.
I asked Detective Gross how he felt about the credibility of Detective Hartman's informant.
One thing I can tell you about Mel, his informants didn't BS. And if it wasn't for Mel showing me how to be a police officer and how to handle informants, I probably wouldn't have been a very good police officer. I owe a lot to Mel for the way that I started to police because Mel showed me how it should be done. So Mel, I'm telling you, Mel had some of the best informants, and he usually didn't disclose who his informants were. But this informant said that they would go with us to Detroit. I mean, we went to a couple apartment buildings and interviewed people, trying to find some of these guys. I would have told Mel, I think he's full of BS, but everything and how it went down and how he explained everything and how he explained what he saw that night, there's no doubt. No doubt in my mind. Nope, this informant was out of prison, leading their life.
Without knowing the confidential informant, or CI for short, there's a couple observations I made based on what the detective said. First, the CI wasn't working off criminal charges. That's to say, he wasn't looking for a deal with prosecutors in exchange for information, which can always lead to suspicion about their motive to provide information. Second, the informant went with detectives to Detroit to demonstrate his knowledge, providing context to what he was saying. And third, if you believe that the CI possessed information about the concealment of Natasha's body after the fact, those could be what we call admissions against his penal interest, meaning that the information he's providing could get him into trouble, which lends credibility to an informant. Investigators who have worked or continue to work on this case have not forgotten about the little girl who seemingly vanished into thin air. The disappearance of Natasha has permeated the police department's history. New cops coming on the job are told about the still-missing 6-year-old. Here's Jackson, Michigan Police Detective Michael Galbraith.
I've been made well aware of it the whole time I've been at JPD for the last 22 years. You always new guy back in 2000. Took you down Maple Street. Well, this is where Natasha Shaines went missing, and there's still one of the older open cases currently within the Jackson Police Department.
We were curious about the theory that Natasha could be buried at the Shaines home on Maple Ave. Mandy Shaines told us about a memory she had from childhood. It occurred sometime following her sister's disappearance. She remembered digging in the yard to make a pond when she began finding bones, which she put into a bucket. Mandy traveled to Texas shortly after, and she said when she returned to Michigan, the bones were gone. We found some reports that said one of the children took the bones to school, but there were no details of why someone didn't intercept the bones and give them to investigators, especially if they knew Natasha was missing. But later, Mandy found one more bone in the same spot and took it to the police station, where she was later told that it was not human. Reports say that Susan Shaines would not let police do any digging on her property. But in 2023, according to Detective Galbraith, police had their opportunity to thoroughly search the former Shaines home when the city took over the condemned property. They even enlisted the services of cadaver dogs and an anthropologist in the search, but there was no signs of a body. I asked Detective Hartman what he thought about that theory.
They dug up the house there in Jackson, tore it down and everything, but she's not there. She never was. She never went back to that house. She went directly to Detroit.
But the search of the Maple Avenue property in Jackson, Michigan, was just one of the boxes that police wanted to check off their list. There are still those lingering questions surrounding the people who were after Robert Forbes, as well as questions about Forbes himself.
There's some things that revolve around the relationship that Natasha's mother had, Mr. Forbes at the time, who was involved in various criminal activities with different gangs throughout the mid-Michigan and southeastern Michigan area.
Because Forbes was tied to the underworld, Detective Galbraith said that several leads came in throughout the investigation from people saying they had information about the case, but nothing panned out. And the theory that Natasha was taken by alleged criminal associates of Forbes by mistake, that they may have been after his son with Susan rather than Natasha, who was not his child, Galbraith said that theory's never been proven. Through the years, several people have come forward claiming to be Natasha, but to date, none of those claims has ever been confirmed. Former detectives Mel Hartman and Nat Gross have not been directly involved in this case for several years, but it haunts them to this day. And when I spoke with them, they still want answers. I asked Detective Hartman what it would mean to him to be able to find Natasha.
That's been my lifelong goal ever since that she disappeared, was just to find her and return those remains back to the family.
The case remains open at Jackson, Michigan PD. Here's Detective Mike Galbraith.
You know, it's always going to stay open until we can confirm or deny the fact that, one, she's either still alive and we can identify who the young lady is and they can be reunited, or unfortunately, but fortunately, find her remains of some sort to confirm that the young child was murdered.
Again, retired Detective Nat Gross.
As hard as we've worked it and as long as we've worked it, because when I did cold cases up in the prosecutor's office, I could get a homicide usually, go back through, and the secret to redoing and solving a cold case is to actually re-interviewing everybody. It isn't a lot of times the DNA, it's not the latent fingerprints, it's not any of that stuff. It's getting back and re-interviewing all your witnesses. Because allegiance has changed, alliance has changed, and people sometimes, their conscience gets them, sometimes the good Lord upstairs gets them, and they feel like they've got to tell the truth. And in this case, the people that we were dealing with don't have basically a conscience, and I don't think it's ever going to change. I wish it would, but I don't think it will. And as it stands right now, the guy that we really think did it is deceased, so who are we going to charge? We're not going to be able to charge anybody.
Police understand that even though their unnamed suspect is dead, that should not be the deciding factor in whether the search for Natasha continues. I asked Mandy about life after her little sister went missing. She told me that she and her siblings didn't really have a childhood after that. The family spent every minute traveling and posting flyers of Natasha in every state they could. Mandy said they never found any answers, and without closure, there's no peace. But despite that, she says the family is still close, and they look forward to any new information about Natasha. Again, here's retired Detective Nat Gross.
Nobody or any child should be someplace where they're not, even though their loved ones aren't going to be visiting them every day, shouldn't be in a spot where somebody can't find them if they want to. I'm sure the city of Jackson will suck up the cost of digging up the body if we find one. I mean, how do you not, now you can solve a homicide and we can say we solved it. I think that's the biggest thing. It's money. Money right now is I think the biggest factor in why we're not digging it up. I mean, there's no guarantee we're going to find it, but if you take ground penetrating radar or sonar, and you go through and you suddenly find there's a square box down there, looks like a piece of luggage, or you look at the fact that there's a body down there.
What we do know is that Natasha Shaines has never been seen since she disappeared from her family home on Maple Avenue in Jackson, Michigan, more than 38 years ago. Could officials in Detroit hold the key to helping solve this decades-old mystery? Retired detectives Nat Gross and Mel Hartman thought so. They've been retired for several years, but still hold a passion for solving this case. In fact, when I first spoke with Detective Hartman, he was hospitalized. When I learned that he was speaking to me from his hospital room, I told him that our interview could wait, but he insisted on talking to me. I could tell that Mel, like so many other cops, take cases involving child victims very personally. It was something he would not forget, and he wanted to share whatever he could in hopes that Natasha could be found. His money was on Detroit. Just days after our interview, Detective Hartman passed away. We dedicate this episode to Natasha Shaines and to Detective Mel Hartman, who never gave up on finding her. If you have any information on the disappearance of Natasha Shaines, call Jackson, Michigan PD at 517-788-4100. Or you can make an anonymous call to Crime Stoppers of Mid-Michigan at 517-483-7867.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.